Women Rule is produced by Politico in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. This episode is brought to you by our supporting sponsor, Chevron. Chevron is proud to partner with TechBridge Girls, an organization on a mission to inspire girls to pursue STEM careers through hands-on learning. By supporting after-school programs, Chevron is helping TechBridge Girls get more girls interested in STEM.
Voters jolted the makeup of the House, marking a dramatic shift in the gender divide.
A record number of women, people from different ethnic backgrounds, and
there are a huge number of women who are first-time candidates, and they are overwhelmingly Democrats.
It's the day after a historic midterm election, and here at Women Rule, we're breaking down what happened, from the races women won and could have won last night, to how women voters turned out at the polls. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook. First, I want to introduce our listeners to the two Politico women here with me to discuss it all, Carrie Budoff-Brown and Elena Schneider. Carrie is our editor here at Politico, the big boss, leading all of our coverage of the elections.
Hi, Anna.
And Elena is a Politico campaign reporter. She's hit the trail all over the country this midterm cycle, so she has a lot of insight to share from the road.
Hey, Anna.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining me this morning.
Great to be here.
I know we all got lots of sleep.
Tons.
So
I feel very well rested.
Perfect. Well, let's take a look at the numbers. Carrie, set the scene for us. We've been talking about why this election is so groundbreaking for months now on women and how many women are running. But give me some of the specifics. How many women ran? And more importantly, how many won or that we know won mm-hmm. today?
So right now, women make up nearly 20% of Congress, and they were at a total of 107 women, an all-time high. And then last night happened. Now there are a record-breaking number of women in Congress. As of this taping, at least 117 women have won their midterm elections.
Yes, yeah, so some interesting things here, right? I think you can pull up. Women were basically stuck in Congress at that 20% marker for quite a while. They were unable to kind of push beyond that. This cycle fueled, I think, largely in part of because of the Trump presidency, the march, right? We saw this enthusiasm for women, particularly on the Democratic side.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've been chronicling it for, you know, 2 years now. Huge surge for Democratic women. Elena, what did you see on the Republican side with women, particularly in the House?
We did see a couple of Republican women who were able to either be on the verge of winning or flip some seats. I mean, one in particular that I'm still watching is Young Kim in California. Mm. She would be the first Korean-American woman to serve in Congress, and she looks like she's holding on there. Look, there's still a lot of ballots out and could take weeks to see who wins in California, but that's one in particular that I'm watching. Mm-hmm. But the Democratic women really are the ones bearing a lot of the weight here in terms of changing the composition of Congress. And we saw that starting in the primaries. I'll never forget in Texas back in March of this year when we saw women across the board were winning those runoffs, and not only one, but two of them were winning to then take on each other to see who would win those primaries. Women got a bump. Democratic primary electorate voters wanted to vote for women, and that's a huge part of the reason why we saw so many women nominated in these primaries and then go on to win a lot of these general election races. And as of right now, sort of stepping back and looking at just the House in terms of what flipped and who built the majority for Democrats here, of the 30 seats that we know have flipped so far at this point in the taping, 19 of them are women. Wow. So that's about two-thirds of women carried those flip seats for Democrats. So they're a hugely important, critical piece to what made Democrats flip the majority.
One of the things we were talking about a little bit before we started recording that I have been kind of tracking this whole cycle and a lot on this podcast is how women have portrayed themselves in this cycle, kind of owning their message in a way that I don't think I've ever seen before, kind of throwing out the stereotypical pearls and power suits on the trail to really embracing the fact that life is messy and they often have kids and, you know, their hair isn't done perfectly, you know, every time. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about some of the campaign ads you guys saw, things that stuck out to you.
But I think you pick up on that. You know, these ads were different. They were revealing. They were meant to be authentic. I wonder how much Hillary Clinton played into that strategy these past 2 years. I think the big rap on Hillary Clinton and how she ran her race was that she wasn't herself. She wasn't authentic enough. I mean, I'm sure she would say, I was plenty authentic. I was myself, and that's who I am, and they never accepted me. But there was so much control put around Hillary Clinton for so many years, and that this cycle you just saw women being women because it worked, right? I think the Times, you know, allowed that to happen, but it really... One of my big questions last year was like, how do women run after 2016? And I think we saw a pretty clear answer that they are themselves, or they should try to be themselves. Don't try to be somebody else. And we saw that in the ads, which Elena can probably walk us through with greater detail. But these were amazingly sort of compelling ads.
Well, one in particular that I paid special attention to because she ran in both 2016 and in 2018 was Angie Craig in Minnesota. She lost in 2016 and was able to and ran very much in sort of the vein that you just described. She was a woman in a blazer standing in a boardroom talking about what she was going to be able to do in Congress.
At the company I help lead, our products save lives. I wanted to help our employees live better ones. We did good by doing what's right. Time to make Congress do the same.
We saw a completely different Angie Craig come 2018. She was standing in front of bales of hay with her kids, wearing vests and like checked button-down shirts, very much being more like a suburban mom.
I started a family and had to fight like hell for the right to adopt my son, Joshua. My wife, Cheryl, and I are raising four sons. We know how lucky we've been.
And I think that they realized that was going to be a lot more compelling to voters, but also, as you said, authentic to what kind of lives women are leading, and that it's you don't have to be a politician at the exclusion of everything else that is your life.
So I want to get into some specifics here. I want to talk about the historic pivotal races where women did lead the narrative. What were the races? Maybe we can break it down by kind of sections, because that's how my brain works. So we can kind of start with the Senate, then we can go to some of the governor's races, and obviously, you know, we spent a ton of time on the House. But let's just talk about some of these historic kind of pivotal races, some of them still unresolved, right? Arizona Senate, the McSally versus Sinema race was something that I think all of us have been watching, one, because of just the nature of the demographics of Arizona, but also you had two women running against each other for the first time in that state. You had Kristen Sinema, who's kind of a liberal, and the Republicans tried to paint as this kind of fringe character who was, you know, kind of on the real left side of things, where you had Martha McSally doing ads where she was a fighter pilot.
You're right. So there are a number of Senate races that really delivered some interesting answers on female candidates. Two that we saw go down in particular were Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota and Claire McCaskill in Missouri. But they're also going to be replaced, like you said, obviously by somebody, some female candidate from Arizona. And then also Jackie Rosen, who was able to take out Dean Heller in Nevada. And I think that was one of the few bright spots that Democrats feel like they were able to claim in the whole Senate map this cycle.
Yeah, the Senate was pretty dire, a dire night for Democrats, for sure.
I mean, it was a bloodbath.
For sure. What about, Carrie, on the governor's side of things? I mean, we spent so much time, and sometimes when you look back, right, it's like, were we spending time on the right races, or sometimes it's just because those are the races that have the best ads or the kind of more interesting, you know, candidates? I mean, I look at this Georgia race, Stacey Abrams, so much attention put on that.
Yeah, so much, and rightly so, right? Like, she's a compelling, compelling political figure who had all the right ingredients, experience, despite what Donald Trump said about her, that she's not experienced enough. She ran a race. It's very close. She's not giving up. As of this taping, she's not giving up. She wants to push it to a runoff. But the way Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum captured sort of the Democratic Party, the fact that both of those, but particularly Stacey Abrams, went down, I think, you know, signals sort of the hope that was placed in her, the sort of and the sort of disappointment today that like something just didn't fully click.
Mm-hmm. What about, there were some other kind of historic races that I think will obviously make the fabric of what the House and the Senate and some of these state houses look like. They're going to be very different, right? You had Ilhan Omar, the first Somali-American congresswoman in Minnesota, taking the Keith Ellison seat. You had Deb Hyland, the first Native American congresswoman. You spoke about Young Kim being potentially the first Korean-American woman. What impact do you think, beyond just, yes, there's going to be more women here, but it's a much more diverse representation of the country?
I think it's going to radically change the composition of Congress and the way that it looks demographically and generationally. You mentioned Ilhan Omar. Rashida Tlaib out of Michigan is another, you know, the two first women who are going to serve in Congress as Muslim women. We have two new Native American members of Congress, Sharice Davids out of Kansas and Deb Haaland, as you mentioned. We've also got very young women. We have two women who are elected in their 20s, which I believe are the first two women ever to be elected in their 20s. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of New York and Abby Finkenauer, who took out Rob Blum in Iowa. They're both
very surprising.
They're both 29, and they're both going to be, you know, definitely people to watch in the coming years. So I think that, and they're not alone. There's just a huge wave of millennial women who are heading into Congress that I think it's just going to really alter the way that things look there.
What tangible ways do you think it will? Like how they legislate, how they operate?
Maybe this is too hopeful in a cynical world, but maybe more bipartisan, maybe more efforts to work across the aisle. Mm-hmm. There's certainly, every time that I've seen evidence of that, it's often led by women. So maybe we could see more work in that sense. But I think also there's going to be just an interest in speeding things up. We haven't talked about leadership yet, but I think that the composition of Democratic leadership, you know, Nancy Pelosi aside, is really going to, you know, we'll see how that affects things too and who they want representing them.
Yeah, I think one of the things is super interesting, if you even look at the Northeast Corridor, I think people would be surprised, for example, that Pennsylvania is going to have its first women in that delegation since 2015. You look at Massachusetts, Ayanna Pressley will be the first Black woman to represent that state. And I think the thing that I find most interesting about some of these races is they weren't backed by the establishment, so they were in runoff candidates. So that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, and others. So they aren't necessarily beholden in the same way that kind of the party politics dynamics can really push people to have to vote certain ways. A lot of them aren't taking corporate money. So how does that impact, you know, where they can maybe find interesting bedfellows to work together on legislation where they want to just get something done versus kind of the ingrained party politics? This is what the leader says. This is where we're all going to vote.
I think that's a great point. When we took a look at the composition of the primary winners back in September, so I haven't done the math yet in terms of who actually won their general elections, but we had 2/3 of Democrats running in the House had never held elected office before. They are doing these campaigns without sort of the traditional backing, as you said, and in fact have been funded mostly by small dollar donors that aren't people who show up at Nancy Pelosi's Napa Valley, you know, donor retreat.
Right.
So I do think that there's going to be some interesting power shifts because of that.
You know, Anna, sorry to turn the microphone, the table's on you, but Anna has covered Capitol Hill for years. I mean, I would love to hear from you. Like, give me some gritty, like nitty-gritty examples of what a caucus, a conference with this many more women practically means, like just how the Hill works, the bathrooms, lactation rooms.
Women barely, they only got a bathroom off the House floor like in the last handful of years, right? Right now, their MRAs, which is the money that is allocated to office spending, can't go towards tampons, for example. You know, there aren't a lot of lactation rooms. There aren't a lot of, you know, when you look at the Senate, for example, they just changed the rules so that a baby could go onto the Senate floor because they're confronting issues, I think, that are generational issues, but are also societal issues in a way that they've never had to before. I think it will be very interesting to see, does the fundraising aspect of this community, right, which is Capitol Hill, this small community of lobbyists and consultants and lawmakers, which typically happen at night, which typically happen, you know, they're boozy, they're drinking. Like, I don't know that a lot of moms want to be home, you know, tucking their kids into bed, getting them ready for school the next day. The other real question I have is with some of these younger moms is, do they move their family? Is there a culture shift back to office holders choosing to say, hey, like, it's important for me. I want to be a present mom. I don't want to be gone 4 days a week and come in on the weekends. And, you know, that was in the 70s and the 80s, that was really what happened here. There was a lot more bipartisanship because people knew each other, because they hung out, they lived in the same neighborhoods. Does that change just as a cultural shift when you think about some of the pressures and the family dynamics?
Yeah. And I also think about the effect of having more women in Congress who are invariably going to be giving opportunity to more women on their staff. And the amplification of that is going, I think, going to be something to watch. And I think you can see these things building on one another, where there's just going to be more opportunity for women.
And now, a message from Chevron. How do you get more girls in STEM? Right now, women make up almost 25% of STEM jobs. And Chevron wants to grow the number of women in STEM careers. They've partnered with TechBridge Girls, an organization that's all about helping young women develop essential STEM skills through hands-on learning, field trips, and engaging with STEM professionals. Chevron is proud to support their after-school programs and help celebrate positive role models. Together, TechBridge Girls and Chevron are on a mission to inspire more girls to pursue careers in STEM. Before we wrap this up, I want to ask you about surprises from last night. Elaine, I'll go to you, and then Carrie, I'm putting you on the hot spot. Give me one race that you maybe weren't watching, or you were, but the outcome was different than you expected.
So we've been beating the drum about suburban voters and the coming backlash in the suburbs. And look, we saw that happen last night. But the depths to which that backlash hit was played out in Oklahoma. Oklahoma City delivered Kendra Horn, a Democrat who, former congressional aide, somebody who, if I'm being completely honest, had not heard much about until last night. And she was able to take out Congressman Steve Russell. And I think that that's another place where, you know, Democrats were able to slide in on that suburban backlash. And it's going to be very difficult for Republicans to return to make inroads there in future years.
For me, I was surprised by the lopsided nature of the Tennessee Senate race. The Marsha Blackburn-Bredesen race was fascinating from the beginning because it was Bob Corker giving up his seat. He didn't really favor Marsha Blackburn.
That's such an understatement.
Right?
Yeah, oh, right. But, okay, yeah, so, I mean, right. I agree with you. Yes.
So, and there was this fascinating interchange early in that thing, where early in that fight, where Corker considered going back into the race, and Marsha Blackburn just like smacked him down. She was like, you know, I can't even recall, but it was basically like, dude, if I weren't a woman, you wouldn't be doing this to me right now. And she owned it. She owned that double standard. And I have to say, I was impressed by that. And I think the outcome, I think there was a lot of hand-wringing in recent weeks about, is Bredesen going to pull it out? And she stomped on him, whatever you want to call it. Sorry, I'm tired. But like, I thought that was pretty fascinating. And I would love to know a little bit more about sort of what transpired there.
It's going to be very interesting. She's the first woman to represent them in the Senate, the state in the Senate. And she has had problems going up. She's been very ambitious in the House and has not been able to move up on the leadership ranks. And so I think saw that that was not going to be there, decided to take this opportunity. And I mean, if anything, that the big question there is what happened with the polling, because the polling was completely off about how close that race was. I mean, she totally trounced him. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about women voters. We've kind of on the margins been discussing this with the suburban boom for Democrats, and I know we're early on, so we don't have a ton of numbers and kind of actual hard stats. But there was so much focus on what happens with women. What does this mean for the Trump 2020 race? Can you give us a little bit of a picture, Elaine, like what you saw just and what you kind of expect to, you know, potentially hear in the next couple of days?
So the gender gap is quite large. Mm-hmm. Democrats are picking up more and more women in terms of their and can count on them for their coalition. So I was looking back at Reuters did some early exit polls. And granted, like you said, we'll get more data on this in the coming days. But in 2014, 49% of women said that they backed congressional candidates. And in 2018, 55% of women backed Democratic congressional candidates. So I think that that sort of encapsulates just a bit, at least on the House side, what we saw coming out of Democratic women. I think there's going to be some super interesting breakdowns in terms of where white women fell versus minority women. It's obvious and sort of clear so far in exit polling that minority women broke very hard for Democrats. But it'll be interesting to dive into those white women numbers once we get more data back.
I also think, too, one of the things I really want to, I think is important to think about is the rural versus urban vote. I mean, I think just in general, the breakdown there, because it seems to be so, I mean, when you were going county by county last night watching this, right? I mean, it was so clear cut where the city and the suburbs were going for a lot of Democrats, and where a lot of the rural voters were still kind of in Trump country, performing at those same levels. But I think that's going to be super interesting. And how do, when you look at some of these Senate races for Democrats, where they lost?
Yeah.
I mean, they really lost those voters, and they have not been able to figure out a pathway forward.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Davis, who used to lead the NRCC, told me last night that the Republican base has migrated from the country club to the country. And I think that that perfectly crystallizes what we've seen. And it's not new. This has been happening and trending that way for a number of years. But Trump certainly exacerbated it. And by what we saw in his sort of campaign swing in the last couple of weeks, he recognized that and decided to just go for it and gin up his base in those rural Senate states and put some senators over the Republican Senate candidates over the line and basically left suburban Republicans out to dry.
Yeah, there was a lot of hand-wringing about the president's strategy there, and clearly, you know, he was successful in a lot of those Senate races, kind of continuing to go down that pathway. So we're about to wrap up here, but I want to talk about final takeaways from election night, at least, you know, hours later. I'm sure we'll, you know, weeks later we'll kind of have different maybe takes, but there's still a few races we're waiting on as of this taping. Alina, what are we still watching?
So I'm still watching California, and that's probably going to take weeks to totally sort out. But look, there are seven districts that Hillary Clinton won where Republican incumbents are sitting in, and it looks like in at least four, Democrats have a very real shot. Some of them with women. Katie Hill, who's taking on Steve Knight just north of L.A., is one that looks incredibly close that she might be able to pull out. And Young Kin, again, is another one that we could also see another history-making candidate there for Republicans.
So we talked a little bit about Nancy Pelosi and House leadership, the bench, and kind of the how distinctly different they are with the members that are coming in, how young they are, how diverse they are versus the top of House Democratic leadership. So far, no one has said that they are going to challenge Pelosi. It appears that she will, kind of be the speaker once again. Rarefied air. I believe there's only one Speaker, Republican Sam Rayburn, who was Speaker, was not, and then was Speaker again. Little factoid. but what do you think? What do you see, Carrie, in terms of what are things that we're going to be watching about her leadership, how she chooses to lead?
I mean, Nancy Pelosi is fascinating, and man, she just survives, right? President Trump tweeted about her this morning, and I think this goes to some of the questions we've had about, are women treated differently than men, in the political coverage and the political sphere? And I would say any man who achieved what she has would not be questioning whether she should be Speaker today.
Yeah.
And it's just, there are generational challenges in the caucus, in the conference right now. I think what the women who are coming up and the new class of leaders in the House or members in the House are really going, I think the generational change is coming and happening, and there are going to be new people to watch who will take over the conference. But at this point, there is no man who would be questioned the way Nancy Pelosi is right now and whether she should be Speaker.
So I think you're right. I had a lot of conversations with candidates off the record who said, look, how are we going to retake the House on the backs of women who delivered us here and then boot out the first female Speaker of the House? How do you do that?
You don't.
But
that's why.
But
that's
that how. Being said, Republicans have spent a decade pouring millions and millions of dollars into defining her as this toxic San Francisco liberal. And that is a very difficult burden for these Democrats to bear and carry in these red districts that they just won in. So I think that, look, I think you're right. There are some really fascinating dynamics in the way that we talk about Pelosi and whether or not she would be questioned to this degree, or any man would be questioned to this degree. But I also think that these candidates are put in a tough position, and we just don't know yet in a fuller way as to how this is going to actually come down.
Yeah, I sat down with Pelosi a few weeks ago and talked a lot about this and her legacy and how she views it. And I think two things. I think she is just steely and determined and believes she is truly the only person who could lead this caucus at this time with Donald Trump in the White House. I think she 1,000% would have left if Hillary Clinton would have won. And I think we are going to see what will be very interesting to me is the vast majority of House Republicans have never been in the minority, ever. She has been in the majority before, and her ability in this next month to kind of navigate a lot of new members who have never been there, and she knows how all the power and the levers move. Mm-hmm. And I think there will be a steady hand. However, she does, you know, acknowledge that she's a transitional speaker. I mean, she's not going to be there forever. All right, we are just about out of time. Rena's giving me the wrap, but I do want to ask one question, which I get asked a lot to both of you, which is we spend a lot of time covering women, talking about women. We are women. And so how do you all kind of reconcile those two things? Do you think you approach stories differently? Do we approach content differently? Is that important to do now, given what's happening in Congress? But how does Politico kind of think about that, Carrie?
I think about it a lot. You know, I sit in news meetings a lot every day and all day. And I have a great group of editors who I believe are fantastic. But I do often have to say, are we thinking this way or covering it this way because this person's a woman? Would we say this? How are we characterizing this person? I bring that up, and so do my editors who are men and are women, and I do have to ask that a lot. And do we cover them differently? I think Elena, I haven't been a on the ground reporter in a few years, so I would love to hear Elena's take on that. But there are differences because they are different. You know, there are things that we need to, at the same time, like we do need to recognize that there are differences between men and women. I got about 5 great story ideas in this conversation that I'm going to have to ask my newsroom to do simply because we have more women now, and they're and that brings a different set of a different landscape.
Right.
And but as a person who leads a newsroom that covers politics, you have to constantly test assumptions, how you're characterizing people. And yes, I do pay particular attention to how we do that.
Well, as a reporter, I think we all come in with a lens, right? I can't help the fact that I'm a woman, that I'm a white woman who grew up in North Carolina, one of three sisters. Like, I can't help that that's my lens on the world. That's how I look at it. And I do think that that sort of shapes and informs your reporting. But as a good reporter, you sort of gather all of the facts to sort of paint a bigger picture. But look, I had a really interesting conversation with Abigail Spanberger on Sunday night. We were driving around, back roads of Virginia for final hours of her race that she just squeaked out a victory over Dave Brat, which was a really big deal in this red district. And we were talking about women in politics. And I asked her, you know, she sort of was explaining to me, you know, I get these questions about being a female candidate and whether or not my family is doing okay, or where are the kids? Right. You know, how are they holding? How am I holding up? And at first she said, I was offended by, you know, offended may be a strong word, but, you know, taken aback by that, you know, question whether or not that was sexist. Would a male candidate get those kinds of questions? And then she came to, you know, and you should have her on the podcast to talk about this. She came to this larger appreciation that, look, we're so comfortable and used to having male candidates. We know what that picture looks like, and we're able to very easily fill in the rest of the details. We're not able to do that with women candidates because we're just now getting used to them.
Exactly.
And so I think she felt like she was able to fill in the picture for voters, fill in the picture for people who are genuinely interested at what her life is like. And I think that she took that as maybe not so much as sexist, but simply explaining to people what it's going to be like to have women in politics.
I think that is a great note to end on, because this is what we're going to be focusing on all of 2019.
Yes.
And 2020.
And 2020. So much more. We'll have to have you both back. Well, Carrie and Elena, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was so much fun. Thank you, Anna.
Yeah. Now I'm going to go to sleep.
Women Rule is produced by Rena Flores. Dave Shaw is our executive producer, and our booker is Jessica Andrews. If you're a fan of the show and you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. And one last thing, if you have any thoughts about who we should feature on Women Rule, let me know. Tweet me at @apalmerdc. And of course, hit that subscribe button. And thanks for listening.